This is Yin Radio. Hello and welcome to Yin Radio. Today is Sunday, October 11th, and you're listening to 90.3 KRFP Moscow Pullman. Welcome to our listeners also on other stations and those streaming online at www.radiofreemoscow.org. The Yin Radio webpage, where you can find links to upcoming broadcasts as well as archived Yin shows, is www.yinradioblog.wordpress.com. And you can also find us on Facebook at Yin Radio. My name is Tara Howe, and I am your host. Today's broadcast is Stories of Our Hearts, an interview and reading with Terry Tempest Williams. Terry Tempest Williams is an American author, conservationist, and activist. Williams' writing is rooted in the American West and has been significantly influenced by the arid landscape of her native Utah and its Mormon culture. Her work ranges from issues of ecology and wilderness preservation to women's health to exploring our relationship to culture and nature. She has testified before Congress on women's health, committed acts of civil disobedience in the years 1987 through 1992 in protest against nuclear testing in the Nevada desert, and again in March 2003 in Washington, D.C. with Code Pink against the Iraq War. She has been a guest at the White House, has camped in the remote regions of the Utah and Alaska wildernesses, and worked as a barefoot artist in Rwanda. Williams is the author of Refuge, an Unnatural History of Family and Place, An Unspoken Hunger, Stories from the Field, Desert Quartet, Leap Red, Patience and Passion in the Desert, and The Open Space of Democracy. Her book Finding Beauty in a Broken World was published in 2008, and most recently she published When Women Were Birds, and republished the Robert Jeffries book called The Story of My Heart with her husband Brooke, the participatory reading of which was the purpose of her visit with her husband to the Palouse, from which you will later hear selections on today's broadcast. In 2006, Williams received the Robert Marshall Award from the Wilderness Society, their highest honor given to an American citizen. She also received the Distinguished Achievement Award from the Western American Literature Association and the Wallace Stegner Award given by the Center for the American West. She is the recipient of a Lannan Literary Award for Nonfiction and a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship in Creative Nonfiction. Williams was featured in Ken Burns' PBS series The National Parks, America's Best Idea, and in Stephen Ives' PBS documentary series The West, which was produced by Burns. In 2011, Williams received the 18th International Peace Award given by the Community of Christ. Williams is currently the Annie Clark Tanner Scholar in Environmental Humanities at the University of Utah and a columnist for the magazine The Progressive. She has been a Montgomery Fellow at the Dartmouth College, where she continues to teach, and she divides her time between Wilson, Wyoming and Castle Valley, Utah, where her husband Brooke is the field coordinator for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I had the great privilege of speaking with Terry earlier this week in advance of the public readings held by she and her husband Brooke. We delved into the impetus for the current book she's been working on for the past several years, which documents and unravels the history of the national parks, and is a fascinating parallel to the other writer we'll be featuring on the next Yin broadcast, October 28th, Carolyn Finney, who also recently visited the Palouse region and spoke about her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. So, you are all in for a real treat this October as we hear the wise and eloquent words of two amazing women who call each of us into action with their grace. A brief break and we will return to Yin Radio. Hello and welcome back to Yin Radio. I'm your host, Tara Howe. Today's broadcast is Stories of Our Hearts, an interview and reading with Terry Tempest Williams. The title for today's show is based on the title of the Robert Jeffries book, The Story of My Heart, the most recent publication that Terry and her husband Brooke co-contributed on, Terry writing the introduction to this work from the 1800s and Brooke commenting throughout the book on each chapter. Scott Slovic, professor at the University of Idaho, and to whom I owe great gratitude for introducing me to Terry's work and for his commitment to the arts and literature of the environment, has also written the closing words in the most recent edition of the Jeffries book. A public reading of the book was held at WSU this week on Tuesday and also here in Moscow on Monday at the 1912 Center. The interesting aspect of this particular reading, however, was that it was participatory, meaning that those in attendance had the opportunity to contribute their voice to the reading. A main part of the impetus behind this novel reading had to do with the way in which Terry and Brooke came to know the story of My Heart in reading its passages to one another over the period of several years, reaffirming the soul life and their commitment to one another as a couple. I think you will find, as you hear Terry's voice in interview and in her readings, she possesses a grace that has at its heart a desire for all of us to be in conversation and find a type of communion together in celebration of similarities and differences. This selection from her book, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, speaks volumes. Our survival, the vitality of the planet, she writes, depends on mental flexibility and emotional acuity. Hands raised, hands put to work, we can improvise. We can create without a map, and we don't have to live in isolation. The gift of an attentive life is the ability to recognize patterns and find our way toward a unity built on empathy. Empathy becomes the path that leads us from the margins to the center of concern. Here is Terry Tempest Williams.
First of all, thank you, Tara, for this conversation. More and more, I think face-to-face conversations are gifts, the gift of time that creates a sense of intimacy, especially among women. So I appreciate you, and I appreciate Yin Radio. Where am I right now? I'm in Moscow, Idaho. And that, I'm not being facetious. You know, I think where I am is present wherever I find myself. And it's a pleasure to be here. I haven't been here in a long time, and it's as beautiful as I remember. And to see the Palouse Mountains that render themselves, I think, very centrally and reminiscent of the human body, it's always a gift to return. I just finished a manuscript. I'm still in the process of final edits on our national parks. And so that's been my focus for the last 4 years, really since writing When Women Were Birds, about voice and how do we find our voice? How do we keep our voice? What happens when we lose it? How do we retrieve it? And it may seem like a strange progression from a book about my mother's blank journals to move into a book about public lands. But I think that's really where the source of my voice is and has always been, in wildness. And so I've loved spending these past 4 years thinking about our national parks in general and 10 national parks in particular. And, you know, the irony always, I think, is we think we're going into a book and, oh, this one will be easy. You know, I'm writing about national parks. It's where, you know, coming out of Utah, where we had 5 national parks and 5 national monuments, this is writing about my backyard. But in fact, I think it's been one of the most challenging books I've ever written out of 15. And that's saying a lot when, you know, no book I think that a writer takes on is easy. But this one caught me by surprise. I think just the complexity of the ideas, the shadow side of our national parks, as well as the brightness of the lands themselves. But, you know, there's a dark, complicated history behind, I think, each of our national parks. But how not to dwell on that, but be mindful of displaced people or racism, privilege, these kinds of issues, policies that have failed. But on the other hand, something that is uniquely American, that is about the public commons, that our national parks are our breathing spaces. So it's been balancing both shadow and light with these topics. And I've loved the challenge of that.
Terry and I went on to speak about Carolyn Finney's work for a moment, the author again whom you will hear on the next Ian broadcast. And Carolyn had related a story about when Martin Luther King was hoping to be able to enter the national parks here in the U.S., and it was felt that because of the racial tensions, this was going to be and cause him and his wife difficulty. So this couple, you know, on the edge of the human rights movement, with all of this recognition, still did not have the ability to enter the national parks. And it's this pretty harrowing story that points to some of the darker issues that we've had, some of the shadow sides, as Terry puts it, and as you'll hear from Carolyn Finney in her work. And so I had brought this notion up to Terry, and her response follows.
That's so interesting. You know, certainly there's endless stories of Native people, Indigenous people, tribal people, you know, who have gone into a national park and refused to pay, saying these are our lands, these are our tribal lands, this is our home. And they've either been asked to leave or pay the fee or... So yes, you know, it's wrought with racism, African American, Native American, and it's shameful and ongoing.
I asked Terry if she had come to reconcile any of this in the writing of her new book.
You know, I think what I have reconciled is the complexity. And as one who has come into public lands as an activist and a single-issue activist in terms of wilderness, especially in the American West and what that means, you know, I think it's just appreciating the complexity of the national park system. I think it's recognizing that it mirrors the United States of America. And so a book where I thought it would be a straightforward inquiry on our national parks is really a look at America itself, and that I wasn't prepared for. And I think it's a book where I've really been faced with my own limitations as a writer. You know, I'm not a historian. I'm not a scientist. I don't work for the Park Service. I'm a citizen. And I approached it that way. And I think, you know, whatever authority I have, it's simply in being a participant and a visitor. So in that sense, you know, it could have been titled Visitor.
Terry's beautiful notion of not wanting to take on too much of an authoritative voice in any one manner, I thought was very interesting. Brought up the ways in which, of course, science is often held up as the only authoritative voice, that public lands policy can be held up similarly, and just how important it is that we have this variety of voices, including her own, to speak to these other forms of knowledge and embodied knowledge, simultaneously with the recognition that is just one of the many voices we need to hear.
I think the subtitle saves me in that it's, I'm calling it The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. So I chose 10 national parks, beginning with Grand Teton, which is, you know, where our family's been going for years, and we live there now and have for the last 10 years, going back and forth between Castle Valley, Utah, and Jackson, Wyoming. So, you know, that's what I've never been able to reconcile is, you know, my love for the Northern Rockies, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and the Colorado Plateau in Utah. So I think, you know, that's a dance, but I've always loved both the desert and the mountains. And so those are two of the parks that I look at, Grand Teton National Park and Canyonlands. And others are Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, Acadia National Park in Maine, the first Eastern National Park, Gettysburg National Battlefield, which I became obsessed with and knew nothing about, had never been there, and went back repeatedly. Big Bend, which I'd never been to, and I could disappear there forever, and if I do, that's where I'll be. Gates of the Arctic, which is a true wilderness park in Alaska. Alcatraz, which is part of the Golden Gate National Recreational Area. The Gulf Islands National Seashore, which is in the Gulf of Mexico where the BP oil spill was. Effigy Mound National Monument. Have you ever heard of that? Nor had I. And honestly, I think it has to be in my top five places that I've ever been in the world, ever. So powerful. On the banks of the Mississippi River between Iowa and Wisconsin. These amazing mounds, many of them burials, many of them effigies in the shape of bears, wolves, a bird that to me looked like a falcon, 216 feet across. I mean, unbelievable. We did not see one person there and had this incredible experience with the archaeologist there at the National Monument named Albert LeBeau, who is Lakota and just fascinating. It was amazing. And again, you know, I think with each of these parks in different ways, this sounds crazy, but I felt so patriotic in the sense of that this truly is the open space of democracy. And for all of our errors, for all of our cruelties, for all of our mistakes, for all of our shortcomings, there's still something very powerful that rises up from the land itself. And the last chapter, the last two chapters, I think, speak to where we are now. One, Glacier National Park. In the next 15, 30 years, there may not be any more glaciers. So the very namesake is gone. And, you know, the terrible dark history of how the Blackfeet Nation was treated by the National Park Service. Now their flag, the Blackfeet flag, flies, you will appreciate this, you know, between the United States flag and the Canadian flag. And I believe that it won't be very long before they share with the National Park Service in governance. And the last chapter is on Cesar Chavez, and I do think that's where the future of our parks is going, with this kind of diversity and honoring and respect of people of color and their role in land. And certainly Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta exemplify that. And that is one of our most recent national monuments that President Obama created in 2012. So I've loved doing the research. I've loved being at these places. And in each instance, each park, each monument, each national seashore could be its own book. So humbled is the word I would use. Humbled and very, very aware of my limitations as a writer.
Our conversation continued about voice and each of our voices and the conversations we have.
I think it's so powerful. And I think it's all part of this larger conversation. And, you know, one of the things that I don't believe, you know, is there's been a lot of conversation that our national parks are no longer relevant, that they're not being visited. That certainly hasn't been my experience. And I think there's a reason that close to 300 million people visited our national parks last year. And, you know, with the larger landscape parks that you see in the American West, Grand Teton broke all records. Yellowstone was so crowded this summer, I could barely even stand to go in there. It was so crowded with bison jams, 2 hours long. You know, it could be argued the other side is that many of our parks are being loved to death, Yosemite among them. I asked one of the backcountry rangers, what's a day in the life of a backcountry ranger? And she said, you mean yesterday? And I said, sure, that'll do. And she said, I went with an intern. We climbed up halfway up Half Dome, and we picked a spot, and in a 2-foot radius, not 2-mile radius, 2-foot radius, they picked up 5 pounds of toilet paper. So, you know, that's the other side. And then the contrast is, you know, you go to a place like Effigy Mounds, and Brooke and I hiked 15 miles looking at these extraordinary formations built by the mound builders 1,500 years ago, and we saw no one. So there's a huge range.
So I do apologize that I am having to reiterate my questions as they were for Terry. It was such a nice conversation. Unfortunately, in my delight to be there in the conversation, I forgot which recording tools I was using, and so I wasn't speaking close enough into the mic. So I'm just trying to reiterate some of the, you know, the essence of the questions that were being asked, and in following up on these ideas, you know, I was just checking in to see then if her book was looking obviously into, as it sounded, the ideas then of, you know, whose land ownership, who's got rights to land, who speaks for the land, and all of these types of questions.
Yeah, those are all the questions, and I don't have any answers. You know, I think where I place my faith is in what E.O. Wilson is advocating of half Earth. You know, that if we are going to, as a species, move through this bottleneck that he talks about now, climate change, gender equality, food equality, all of these things, it will require, and this is his voice as a scientist, that half the world be maintained in wildness. And that if we take care of the earth in that way, then the earth takes care of us. So that I think this split of the wild and culture doesn't exist. But it's how do we take care of both? And I think that's our challenge before us. And a lot of that does have to do with restoration and issues of power and story and respect for indigenous rights and the rights of other species. And I loved Orin Lyon, who, as you know, is one of the elders in the Seneca Nation. He said, it can no longer be about the color of our skin. It has to be about the color of our blood. And I love that. Because I think so often we can become so fractured as a people, as a nation, as a world, that we fail to see where we stand as human beings.
From this conversation, we led into a discussion about the tar sands, and as it related actually to some of my experience in growing up in Canada and what has now happened, obviously, to the destruction of the tar sands in northern Alberta, and moreover, the destruction of an entire people, and that in considering this to be this industrial complex, this whole industrial-based notion that we are still so often, despite all the wonderful work being done here, nationally speaking, we are forgetting the people.
And the cancers now among the native people, and the doctor who worked for the Canadian government, right, and who blew the whistle and then was fired. We're seeing this just in the beginning stages in Utah, in the Book Cliffs, where I think many people don't realize America's first tar sands mine is. And just on the other side of the Book Cliffs, Vernal, Utah, where it's one of the largest oil and gas booms around, very high infant mortality rate. And the midwife, who again blew the whistle, has been shunned. Yeah, it was one of the features in Rolling Stone. So,
and I was proud of Rolling Stone for doing that.
Exactly. And, you know, people in Utah, nobody's even talking about it. So we're talking about it. I'm involved in the Environmental Humanities Graduate Program at the University of Utah. And for the next 2 years, we're taking this issue on and asking the question, how might the lens of environmental humanities inform our state and beyond? How might we think about tar sands? How do we talk about these issues of fossil fuel development in the midst of climate justice? Much of the mine is surrounded by ute lands, by school trust lands, by wilderness study areas, by communities. So it's a very, again, dynamic, complicated issue of land and rights. So I'm excited to see what we learn.
I was very excited to hear about this curriculum they were putting together, and I had asked Terry if this was a primarily cross-disciplinary group.
Lots of different points of view, and a lot of listening, a lot of dialogue with artists, with scientists, with oil and gas executives, workers. I think it's going to be fascinating. Ute leaders working with film. Toby McLeod, who produced, directed a great film called Profit and Loss about the tar sands in Alberta, is going to be doing a public showing at the Vernal Library, which I think will be amazing. And health workers, so we're really excited. And the young activists who have been at the encampment at PR Springs at the top of where the mine is, and some great local activists. Tim DeChristopher will also be part of the curriculum. So we're really excited about the ground truthing this year, and then see what actions rise out of that.
Ground truthing, is that your term? I haven't heard that term before, but that's great.
Yeah, it's a term that cartographers use, that, you know, you make maps from aerial surveys, but then you go to the ground to ground truth what your data shows.
As Terry spoke to me about this group that was being developed, and I thought to all of her experience in activism over the years and some of the violence that she has experienced, and personally, and then obviously in witnessing others experiencing violence, that in going back to my foundation in healing arts, I had questions about cognitive dissonance and the ideas that even when we are interested sometimes in changing, that the reality in front of us, when it doesn't match what we've been told or part of what our beliefs are, can be so frightening that it can in fact prevent us from wanting to or even being able to change at that point in time. And so I had wondered, in this great interdisciplinary program they were putting together, if they had also found some ways to look at that and to perhaps bring those concepts in preemptively.
It's a great point. And it's really something to think about. You know, we're all complicit just by being human. You know, I'm aware every single day of my own hypocrisy. And yeah, it's hard to live with. And, you know, I think we all make our amends and choices to try and minimize our impact. But no, it's tough. And the choices that we're not given are difficult. And, you know, awareness, I think, is the beginning, and paying attention to those things. But cognitive dissonance, you know, again, what does that word mean? You know, how do you make story out of that? You know, as a writer, that's what I'm interested in, is how do you take these kinds of abstract ideas and find the element, you know, in story, so that you can take the abstract and make it real. So I don't know, I need to think about that in terms of the tar sands. I mean, we have a governor who is for it. We have two senators who are for it. All of our congresspeople are for it. You know, and I thought maybe we just need to make bumper stickers, you know, that say tar sands suck, you know, and what do they suck up, you know? How about our air? How about community empowerment? How about water? How about the hope of communities? I don't know. So I think it's a lot about creativity. It's a lot about language. Again, for me, it always begins with conversation and what comes out of those kinds of dialogues. And they are difficult, and they can be abusive, and they can be personal. But I think that it has been my experience, having been in many of those conversations, that if you can listen, the temperature goes down. And, you know, where do we find that common ground? Water's, I think, a good place to start. Air quality is another place to start, especially in Utah. My brother just lost part of his lung. And what was a shock to me is that there are two floors in Intermountain Health Clinic, or, you know, people call it the Death Star in Salt Lake City, Utah, are all lung illnesses, pneumonia, pleurisy. You know, in my brother's case, a serious abscess. So, you know, our bodies don't lie. And Utah has, Salt Lake City in particular, has among the worst air quality in the United States. At one point, equal to Beijing. And a lot of our students, you know, had a campaign of wearing gas masks. So, you know, tar sands isn't going to help that.
Given Terry's involvement in all these movements over the years, I was curious if the embodied notion of being a part of this earth, of feeling our bodies as part of the earth and the earth as part of our own bodies, and a recognition of that interconnectedness, if she found that this was starting to be more recognized or on the rise, say, in the groups she's working with, perhaps politically as a whole, definitely in public policy making. And so that was one of my questions for her, was how was this embodied state being reflected in the current state of institutions?
You know, what comes to my mind, having spent the last 20 days in the hospital with my brother, and we've had a lot of illness in our family and a lot of cancer in our family that I believe is a direct result of nuclear testing in the 1950s and 60s in southern Utah, and where the winds blew was right along the Wasatch Front. And, you know, I don't know of any family in Utah that hasn't suffered multiple cancers in their families. Even the government agreed to this, and there's been some compensation for families in the St. George region, as an example of that. But here's a story. You know, when my brother Steve was dying of lymphoma in 2005, he went to a wonderful place, and I'm sure you know of it, Commonweal, in California, Northern California, right on the edge of Point Reyes National Seashore. And while he was there, he became familiarized with the power of the labyrinth. And Michael Lerner, who's a brilliant thinker and who really started Commonweal with his amazing staff, Rachel Remen among them, you know, I think it was a revelation for Steve to realize that, you know, the body and the mind are one, that it's not about cure but healing. And walking the labyrinth became part of that meditation and that recognition of what constitutes a healing grace. And when Steve realized that, you know, his path was one of healing, not cure, and that he was dying, he made a commitment to create a space where people could have the experience of walking a labyrinth. And so he set that in motion before he died. And his wife Anne and his daughters and so many generous people, and our family included, helped create this labyrinth at the Intermountain Healthcare Center. And last month, while Hank, my youngest brother, was, you know, in treatment for these complications following pneumonia, my other brother, Dan, and I were able to walk that labyrinth that is there because of Steve and Steve's memory. And I just loved that that we could be the beneficiaries, as Steve imagined, of that kind of healing, of that kind of grace. And, you know, on the practical side, it's a quarter of a mile. And on the spiritual side, it's a time to be away from all the machines and beeping and diagnosis and hard things in those rooms that are going on, and just breathe and see Mount Olympus and come out of that labyrinth with a deeper perspective of what life means. And, you know, that's an example to me of how our healthcare system is taking those things into consideration. And looking out the window of Hank's room, that labyrinth was constantly in use by patients, by caregivers, by the medical profession, and I loved that. My father, I think he made it through once, but his, you know, he wanted to walk directly into the center and directly out. You know, so I think it's time, isn't it? I think the labyrinth gives us time, the land gives us time, illnesses give us time. And I think that in a world where everything is measured in time, the irony is that we take so little for ourselves. And that matters to me. And conversation takes time.
In acknowledging that conversation does indeed take time, I was reminded of the introduction she wrote to the Robert Jeffries book, in which she speaks about and refers to his own reference to idle time and this notion that idle time, you know, we get used to this idea as if it's useless somehow, and yet from my perspective and with Jeffries and with everything that Terry and Brooke have been speaking to in this book, it is that idle time where the connection occurs, where the magic occurs, where the mystery and the soul life is. And so I was asking her about this notion of idle time.
I mean, when, you know, usually when you think of the word idle, it's don't idle your car, you know. I mean, it's a word that we don't even use anymore. It's almost an old-fashioned word. And you're referencing Richard Jeffries, whom I love, and my husband Brooke and I fell madly in love with Richard Jeffries and this little-known book of his in the States called The Story of My Heart. He's British. He's in the tradition of Thoreau and Emerson. In many ways, he's considered Britain's first environmentalist, mystic. He was also a great advocate of farmers' rights. But as you say, you know, he loved being idle, and that was really part of his spiritual calling. And every day he walked the same paths in the English countryside, and every day he came into, I think, a heightened sense of what it means to be human in this beautiful and broken world. And I love his passages on idleness. I think I have one we can read. Oh, I love this, I think. Yes, here it is. I hope succeeding generations will be able to be idle. I hope that 9/10 of their time will be leisure time, that they may enjoy their days and the earth and the beauty of this beautiful world, that they may rest by the sea and dream, that they may dance and sing and eat and drink. I will work towards that end with all my heart. If employment they must have, and the restlessness of the mind will require it, they shall not work for bread, but for their souls. I just love that. And, you know, the whole experience of obsession, which is really, I think, what Brooke and I felt with bringing this book back into print from the 1800s, is the importance of the soul life. You know, Jeffries talks about that so much. And I love how The Story of My Heart, the whole book to me reads like a prayer. And he says, by prayer, I do not mean a request for anything preferred to a deity. I mean intense soul emotion, intense aspiration. And it goes back to, I think, that idea of the purpose of life is to see. You know, how do we pay attention? How do we keep our eyes open? How do we not avert our gaze even to the really, really difficult things around us, but to bear witness to the world around us? And I don't think that's a passive act. I think that's an act of immense conscience and consciousness.
When I asked Terry about her own family and how the differences in her own family contributed to her views of nature, differences in spiritual views within the family, having a family that worked the land, and a grandmother who had a really interesting spirit and certain type of beautiful rebelliousness together with Terry, and really influenced her life and these things that you read in through her books. And so I was just curious how family life had impacted her views and where she was with her views now in this regard.
You know, I just don't see the separations, you know, and our family, you know, works the land. They're a pipeline construction company, meaning, you know, they lay the pipe. My brothers have paid the price with their bodies. They're in the ditch with the shovel as the tool of their choice, you know, and they lay the pipes where water, natural gas, sewage, you know, telephone lines, the whole manner of infrastructure that nobody sees, that's been my family's business. The other side is you have my grandmother who was, you're right, highly mystical. And, you know, had Hieronymus Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights, you know, hanging above our bed, or the Buddha, or on her bookshelf, you know, you were as likely to find Krishnamurti and Alan Watts, works as you were Rachel Carson and Edward Abbey, and the Book of Mormon, to, you know, books on art and field guides. So, you know, I thought Joseph Campbell was a Mormon till I got older. You know, so it's our family has, you know, there's a lot of diversity even within our own family in terms of worldview. My uncle just turned 80 last night, and, you know, he was telling me he can hardly wait to go elk hunting, you know, this week. And, you know, last week I was on my back listening to the elk bugling all around me in the sage. So I think everyone finds their way in. And again, how do we create a language as writers that opens hearts rather than closes them, that keeps the dialogue going, that holds back our judgments and yet can still have an activist heart, to try and stop nuclear testing or a tar sands mine in one of the most remote regions in Utah. It's a balancing act, and I think it's never easy, and all of us live in multiple worlds. But, you know, I think there are some great models of how to do this, of how to maintain wildness, but at the same time honor Native communities or local communities within that, so that everyone feels that they have something at stake. On the other hand, I have to be honest, you know, I was appalled at the decision that Secretary Jewell and the Department of Interior and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made regarding the sage grouse. I do think the sage grouse needs the full protection of the law under the Endangered Species Act. And I do think compromises were made to privilege the oil and gas companies. And but that doesn't negate the work that the ranchers have done to try and find greater habitat for the sage grouse, or that the work that different environmental groups have done to try to build those bridges. So it's really complex. But I'm very aware that I still have my own set beliefs that we need more wildlands, not less. But I don't see it at the exclusion of, I see it in correspondence with. And I'm interested in, you know, how do we create unified knowledge? You know, how do we bring the science with the humanities, with religious views? You know, I think one of the great things that the Pope has offered the world is a moral voice to say that climate change, it's not a political issue. It's not just a scientific issue, but it's a moral issue. And if we can act on behalf of climate justice, then everyone benefits. And I have so appreciated his leadership on this. And I think
he came as a good surprise, didn't
it's,
he?
You know, it's wonderful. And, you know, I think there's there have been leaders, world leaders who've been working on this for a long time. I think of His All Holiness, the Patriarch Bartholomew from the Greek Orthodox Church of Constantinople. He's in Turkey, and, you know, was it 1987 at a conference in Santa Barbara? He was the one who said, a sin against the earth is a sin against God. And he's been in conversation with the Pope. You know, I think of Wangari Maathai, who, as we know, won the Peace Prize, the first African environmentalist. And what she was talking about in terms of women and planting trees and knowing that if women had rights and control over their own environment, then they also had control over their own bodies. Again, this interconnectedness. I think that's what we're talking about, is another word for this kind of unified knowledge, because we have been in a world where everything has been segmented, you know, segregated, separated, and I think it's been at all of our expense.
We finished our conversation with a few beautiful comments from Terry and then a wonderful reading that she did.
I cannot think of a more poignant, paradoxical, privileged, wonderful, confusing, critical time to be alive in than we are right now. You know, you talk about transitions. And I really do believe we're in a transitionary moment, both consciously, culturally, spiritually, intellectually, in all ways of how are we now, how shall we live? You know, how do we go forward with everything we know and the questions that we hold and what we see having been set in motion? How shall we live? And I want to live boldly. Tara, I want to be able to take the gifts that I've been given and make use of them. And each of us have been given gifts. So I think the question becomes, you know, how shall we live with the gifts that are ours? And how can we be of use in the communities where we live? And to me, it is local. Otherwise, it's too hard. It's too overwhelming. You know, we're rendered numb and paralyzed. And so I think within our own communities, within our own towns, within our own families, our regions, that's where we can make whole what has been fractured. My voice rises again and again in beauty within the wonder and awe of the spectacle, an exaltation of larks, the murmuration of starlings, a murder of crows, a parliament of owls. And then in the privacy of truth, there is still the repeating courage of one hermit thrush hidden in the woods, singing between intervals of thunder. It is not in sorrow that I am moved to speak or act, but in the beauty of what remains. An albatross on Midway Atoll, dead and decomposing, is now a nest of feathers harboring plastic from the Pacific gyre of garbage swirling in the sea. We can kneel in horror and beg forgiveness, or we can turn away. But the albatross crying overhead, buoyed up by the breeze, is suspended in air by her vast bridge of wings. She is the one who beckons us to respond. How shall we live? How shall I live? I want to feel both the beauty and the pain of the age we are living in. I want to survive my life without becoming numb. I want to speak and comprehend words of wounding without having these words become the landscape where I dwell. I want to possess a light touch that can elevate darkness to the realm of stars. What is time, sacred time, but the acceleration of consciousness? There are so many ways to change the sentences we have been given. We cannot do it alone. We do it alone. How shall we live? Once upon a time, when women were birds, there was the simple understanding that to sing at dawn and to sing at dusk was to heal the world through joy. The birds still remember what we have forgotten, that the world is meant to be celebrated.
My deep, deep gratitude to Terry Tempest Williams for this wonderful conversation that she gave us all the gift of. Thank you so much.